First, we will hear from the Honorable Gary Merritt, who has served as a county judge in Real County since January the 1st of 2011. He previously served as Real County Attorney from 2001 to 2010 and as Assistant District Attorney in the 38th Judicial District. He's a 1985 graduate of Lakey High School, a 1989 graduate of Rice University, and a 1993 graduate of the University of Texas School of Law. Looking at his resume, I'm intrigued by his tenure as team counsel for the Houston Rockets basketball team. Judge Merritt also has a private law practice. Please welcome the Honorable Gary Merritt.
Well, I'm actually very honored to be here. I was speaking a few months ago with Christy Muse about this topic, and we were having lunch and talking about private property rights and how that gets defined in different places and the interaction between that and government regulation. She mentioned the symposium. A couple months later, she asked me if I'd be interested in being one of the panelists. I said, absolutely, I think that would be great. When I saw the full panel, I was just overwhelmed. I would have come here happily to hear anyone here speak because they're incredibly esteemed in their field. And then I looked at it more closely and realized that I'm the government here. these days, as you know, that can have certain connotations, but I will happily accept that challenge, that opportunity, and do my very best to provide you my perspective. As Weir said, I have spent 13 years as a county elected official, but I'm also a landowner, and I'm also involved in agriculture. And most importantly, I'm from a rural part of Texas. And so my opinions are formed by my upbringing and the experiences I've had in county government and representing business owners and looking at things from a lot of different perspectives. I'm going to try to just touch on three points here. First, I'm going to talk about what I see as the proper role of government regarding land development, specifically with regard to private property rights of landowners. I'm going to talk a little bit about when and how the state can decide what constitutes reasonable regulation of water usage. And then I'm going to talk a bit about when regulation constitutes a taking that's deserving of compensation. Fair warning, part of what I'm going to be talking about are specific court opinions. Weir mentioned the Day case. There's another case that came out in August from the Fourth Court of Appeals, which is based in San Antonio and covers this area, called the Bragg case. You should recognize that I loved reading judicial opinions. That's one of the things I do. I will recognize that you may not think the same thing. But it's important to talk about those cases because that often is where our rules get enhanced, clarified, made. I want to start by saying a few words in particular about private property rights and what that phrase means to us. It's a phrase that's well used these days. We are all for private property rights. Private property rights are what made this country great and what made this state great. We need to always be diligent to make sure we protect the private property rights of landowners. So if I ask you in the room here, who is for private property rights? Right, every hand would go up, as it should. But if I also ask you, who in this room likes drinking good, clean water? Every hand would go up. So the question we deal with is, what if one person in this room's complete and unfettered exercise of their personal property rights resulted in everyone else in this room not having good, clean water to drink? And let's take that even a step further. What if one person in this room's exercise of those rights trumped another person in this room's exercise of their own private property rights? Should one person have the right to use their property to the detriment of another person? How about to the detriment of all other people? So that interface, that where one person's rights interface with the collective rights of everyone, to me, that's what the role of government should be, to help with that interface. And that's a role that's constantly being redefined. Every year, in the context of water use regulation, a new Texas legislature shows up and they give new statutory authority. They amend existing laws to take authority away. Sometimes they clarify. For example, two sessions ago, the legislature amended the Texas Water Code to specifically state that landowners have a compensable real property right in the groundwater beneath their land. There's constantly a stream of cases that come down, appellate court decisions that deal with water use regulations. And those cases set and they reset the boundaries of where government regulation is proper and where it's a taking of private property rights that needs to be compensated. And so two of those cases that have come out very recently that are really being looked at as shaping that dynamic is the Day case. That was a 2012 Texas Supreme Court case. That case said that land ownership includes an interest in groundwater in place that cannot be taken for public use without adequate compensation. That's the holding of Day, and a lot of people look at that holding and say that's exactly what Day stands for. But the Day court also says this: the legislature and groundwater conservation districts have broad authority to reasonably regulate in order to conserve groundwater and to protect the natural resources of Texas, such as springs. And then the Bragg case, which came out in August, said that the Edwards Aquifer Authority, they had two permit applications from one landowner. These people owned a pecan orchard, two pecan orchards, and they asked for a water permit, and the authority denied one permit, and they granted one permit, but for less water than the applicants had wanted. And so this Bragg case says that denial of one and failure to fully grant the other was a taking for which the landowner should be compensated. And this case goes into great, great detail about how you look at what's a reasonable taking and what's not a reasonable taking. And that case will be appealed to the Supreme Court, and in a month or a year, the Supreme Court will issue an opinion, and there'll be another case and another case, all dealing with that interface. So this is something that's dynamic. It's constantly changing. So we have the legislature, and we have court cases, and then we also have the daily interaction of interested parties in this. So landowners, government, member groups. We have strong member groups in Texas, like the Farm Bureau and the Texas Wildlife Association. We've got great resource organizations, the Meadows Center for Water and the Environment, Hill Country Alliance. There's constant interaction. There's constant dialogue on how to make the best choices for the state of Texas and to protect the rights of the people that live here. My view of this is that we have to have a balanced approach. We do not need government to solve all of our problems. We may not need government to solve any of our problems by itself. We certainly don't need government to step in and to regulate every facet of every situation. But government absolutely has to be at the table if we're going to find a permanent solution for Texas water needs. And by government, it's an amazing collection of government agencies, political subdivisions that have a voice in this. There are almost 100 groundwater conservation districts. There's the Edwards Aquifer Authority, the TCEQ, Texas Water Development Board. There are 5,000 public water systems in the state of Texas, each one of them with a board of directors. And then you have 254 county commissioners' courts that are dealing with people asking to develop property and asking for subdivision plans to be approved. And so we're all daily confronted with that with that challenge of striking the balance between protecting the public good and protecting private property rights. I don't think that at one individual landowner or the 50 million people that are going to be living in the state of Texas in a few years is more important than the other. We have to have both. We have to protect both. And I want to stress that we need to protect them with a permanent solution. We can no longer expect that rain is going to solve the state's water needs. I expect I'm preaching to the choir here some, but water policy cannot be made anymore based on recent rainfall. We have to have a clearly understood plan for how we're going to address local, regional, and state needs in the short term, medium term, and long term. We have to make sure that plan is adequately funded. And then we've got to work together to carry it out. And we can only do this if government, landowners, interested parties, resource organizations are all together at the table at the same time. We have to have strong leadership in state government, and something that's very near and dear to my heart, we have to have strong local leadership. And we have to be committed to the investment that it's going to take to solve the problem. So I want to talk just a minute about what constitutes reasonable regulation, because that's really what is the greatest challenge, is what is reasonable to one may not be reasonable to another. This is an ongoing dynamic process, as I've said, and we have to make sure that the state of Texas, the state government, is not asked to decide what is reasonable on its own. This cannot be done in a vacuum. It cannot be done only in Austin. It can't be done every 2 years by the legislature. It can't be done only by the court system. We have to use all of those things, yes, but we also have to look at local, regional, and statewide perspectives. I believe very, very strongly in local control of groundwater by conservation districts. I think we need to do more to align the boundaries of those conservation districts with the to better reflect aquifer boundaries, but we need to have some local control there. We have to take, though, regional considerations into account, and we need to look at how various systems are related. So I have some very good friends that are rice farmers in East Bernard, and something that's really important to them is how many people are going to the hula hut on Lake Travis. Because if there's not water in Lake Travis, my friends are not growing rice. Right now, SAWS is looking at developing additional water resources for the city of San Antonio. And they're looking at a variety of things, but one of the things they're looking at is water, available groundwater, let me say, in Kinney County and Val Verde County. And so one of the questions is that a good deal for SAWS? And if so, how do they get the water from those places, which is Del Rio and Brackettville, to the city of San Antonio? And they have every right to make that analysis. But you have to have a regional perspective on this, because if that water goes from Brackettville and Del Rio, it's going to pass through Uvalde. And there are a lot of farmers in Uvalde that are very concerned about a giant pipeline, water pipeline, going through there. And the city, then Uvalde people have tried very, very hard in the last legislatures to keep a water pipeline from going through Uvalde County. Whether that's right or whether that's wrong for each one of us, the point is that we need to, Uvalde County should have a voice in that conversation. They should be at the table when those things are discussed. And then, again, on the regional perspective, I just found out this, that nearly half of this state's population, so 12 million people, relies on a single river in this state, the Trinity River, for some of its water needs. I think that's staggering. So the Trinity River begins up in far north Texas. It has four branches. One of them goes through Dallas, two goes through Fort Worth. They join up, they're south of the Metroplex. That river goes 200 more miles and empties out in the Gulf. It has Dallas-Fort Worth on one end, it has Houston on the other. And so should not that area all have something to say in how the Trinity River gets managed? And this is a great quote from Andy Sansom. He said, every drop of water that's being consumed in Houston from the Trinity River has been through the wastewater treatment plants in Dallas and Fort Worth. So I would expect that they'd want to have something to say about how that happens. Then the last thing I want to talk about is how regulation, when does regulation constitute a taking that's deserving of compensation? And I don't want to get down in the weeds here, but the answer to any question you want to ask is money. So tell me your question. Because that's what this is. This is ultimately, this is how we decide things, is we can argue for or against, but ultimately we quantify things. And so the way that often disputes get quantified, most often, is through a judicial decision. A trial court, an appellate court, the Supreme Court decide something. And so that's what happens now. That's our system, is that someone, a landowner, thinks that the government has overreached in a land use regulation or water use regulation. Most often these days, it's that a permit was not granted. So they sue. There may be an administrative process, but then they file a lawsuit. And the question that gets asked is this regulation a reasonable burden on my use of my property? Because that's what a takings case, that's what they're based on, is we expect that property owners will bear the burden of reasonable regulation on the use of their property, but not unreasonable use. Okay? Zoning is a good example of that. Right? So municipalities have zoning, except for Houston. And you don't see many zoning cases anymore because we accept that zoning is a generally reasonable regulation. So it certainly affects the value of our property. It affects the use of our property if we're subject to zoning. But except for the outlier cases, we agree that the zoning regulations in a city are for the greater good, and so we're okay with that. But here in water use, we're in a new world, and we have a variety of different organizations, a variety of different political subdivisions that issue permits for different things. And so what works in the Edwards Aquifer Authority jurisdiction may not work in the High Plains up in Lubbock. And so you have to go to court to figure that out. And so there's the landowner files a lawsuit. The first question is, was there a taking? That's supposedly what the first question is. But usually what happens is there a reasonable taking? Because if you've got property and you have a regulation, you're going to be able to say usually very fairly effectively, look, this regulation applies to my property and I'm mad about it. That's why I paid for this lawyer and I paid the filing fee and I'm standing up here in court. And then the court looks at a three-pronged test. They look at economic impact, they look at investment, and then they look at the regulation itself. They shake that up. And then what happens is these cases become super fact-intensive. Winners and losers are decided based on the very specific facts of that case and the very specific timeline of the events in that case. The court makes a decision, and then we all look at it to see, how does that apply to us? How does that apply to my fact situation? It's not perfect. It's what we have right now. It's the best we can do. But it needs to be just one part of it. And so my closing is to say this, that government needs to be there. Government needs to be a leader in this by assembling groups of people, interested parties, landowners, organizations, resource organizations, to talk about how we do this. Some things will get wrong, some things will get right. We'll take a step backwards, we'll take one step to the side, we'll move forward two steps. But government needs to be at that table. We need to do the best that we can to come up with a permanent solution to this problem so that we get out of the We only get an answer by filing a lawsuit. Thank you.
Judge, thank you very much. Our second panelist is Joseph Fitzsimmons. He is a third-generation South Texas rancher and has been involved in wildlife conservation for over 30 years, most recently serving as chairman of the Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission. Mr. Fitzsimmons is a graduate of the University of Texas School of Law. He served as vice president of the Texas Wildlife Association and is a director of the Texas and Southwestern Cattle Raisers Association. His awards, honors, and leadership positions are too numerous to mention tonight. On a more personal note, I've had the opportunity to visit his wonderful San Pedro Ranch, located south of Carrizo Springs. Hopefully, he will tell us about his efforts to maintain spring flow at the San Pedro Springs on his ranch. This is a little convoluted, but Mr. Fitzsimmons was due today to fly to Barcelona, Spain to see his daughter. So he put it off one day. Now he's put it off 6 weeks. But regardless of, Joseph, how long you put it off, I think I owe an apology to your wife, Blair, and give her a great big hug for her patience with us. Appreciate you being here very much tonight. Please welcome Joseph Fitzsimmons.
Thank you, Weir, for that kind introduction, and I appreciate very much the judge doing the legal review, because I have to admit that I, too, am a lawyer, and now I don't have to do all that and go straight to the answers, right? Whenever I stand up in front of a microphone, I remember what my old friend and neighbor and mentor, Governor Dolph Briscoe, said once, or actually Janie Briscoe said to him, "Dolph, nobody ever gave a bad short speech." So I am a believer in that, so I'm going to stick to my 15 minutes. I can even do it quicker than that, because I'm intrigued, as you might imagine, because of my background in conservation work and wildlife conservation, and also as a lawyer representing private property owners, and as a private property owner myself, this perception of a conflict between state ownership or management and private ownership, because I don't believe there's a conflict there. I believe they complement one another. And I can make this a short speech by answering the setup question about how did we save the spring. We saved the spring by private property rights, because we were able, we had the power to protect it. And if you don't have that power, if you're dependent on political and bureaucratic solutions that we all know take a long time, you may not have the efficiency to do it. It may be too late. And I'll tell you a little story about that, because we're in the middle of the Eagleford, which everybody knows is the hot oil and gas play. And there's huge demand for water for drilling and fracking. And do you think for 1 minute in this state, if groundwater was owned and exclusively managed by the state, that those oil and gas companies wouldn't have the political clout to dry up my spring and take that water for drilling and fracking?
Amen.
If so, you're not living on the same planet I am. You don't believe that they would prevail. So let's step back and say how, you know, we always talk about private property rights harming the environment. Let's talk about where they protect the environment. And the example I just gave you is my family owns that ranch. It's pretty clear now, both through statute and common law, that we own the groundwater. We were able to price that water Now I'm getting to what I think is the real solution, using markets for environmental good, is we price that water at a point where the companies had to go find technological alternatives to using a lot of water and pay the money to do it because I owned the water. Again, if it was purely a political system of groundwater like we have in the permit system of TCQ, you would end up with the same environmental result as we have with TCEQ, and ask the hooping cranes and the waterfowl along the Gulf how that's worked out for them. It hasn't. When I was at Parks and Wildlife, we were constantly battling the TCEQ over in-stream flows and the needs for water for wildlife. I mean, you know, I felt like Yogi Berra. It's like, fish need water. When you have to say things like that in front of state regulators, you realize how far behind the curve you are. But look at our history of managing water, and I agree with Weir completely. The water doesn't know when it's groundwater, or when it's in a vapor state, or when it's surface water. It is one system. That's absolutely true. But I don't think that means that it all needs to be managed by one, you know, omnipotent central planner. Because I've seen that fail. You know, we had to plead with TCEQ to recognize the need for environmental flows. I'll tell you a perfect example. If we were managing our groundwater the way we manage our surface water, we'd be in serious trouble, because what happened at the last legislative session? People who had prior appropriated rights in agriculture, which we all know benefits wildlife, we all know that it's on those farms and ranches in Texas, it's 98% private lands, that's where the critters are. That's where the habitat and the flora and the fauna are. They're benefiting from agricultural water. It used to be an unintended benefit, but now in Texas it's a very direct and intentional benefit by most landowners. Well, what happened when, as you point out, the hula hut was on stilts instead of on water? What did the legislature, what did a political and bureaucratic system do? They said, no, you know, you're not quite as important as industrial and municipal. You're just ag. Which is really, I mean, let's be honest, that's just a very direct, old-fashioned, political way of saying, I got the votes and you don't. Now, is that the way we want to manage our groundwater? I don't think so. I don't think we should probably manage any of our water that way. But when we start talking about we can't manage the cycle if we have different ownerships, I don't agree. I think those different ownerships can clearly complement one another. The reality is that if you're going to have that cycle work, the watershed's got to work. Anybody that knows anything about conservation and land management, wildlife habitat management, spring flow management, knows, as David Langford likes to say, you know, every drop of water, you know, drops on the land before it becomes either surface water or groundwater, before it enters that cycle. How we manage that land is critical to the quality of the water and the quantity of the water. Well, we have 98% private land. I think that's complementary with private ownership of groundwater. Now, a lot of people confuse private ownership with groundwater and say, oh, well, that means you can pump all you want. No, it doesn't. Read the Day case. We're talking about a clear, I mean, ever since, help me, Judge, what year was the Conservation Amendment to the Texas State Constitution? The 19-teens. We have recognized the power, the police power of the state to regulate for conservation. As a matter of fact, it started in the oil and gas industry. When the Railroad Commission was first formed, an oil company in Houston said, that is a constitutional taking of my property to regulate how we produce oil wells. I should be able to produce whatever I want. And by regulating me, you've taken my property. And the Supreme Court said, wrong. The state has the power to regulate. And it has the power specifically to regulate fugitive substances, is what the old court said. And a fugitive substance is something that moves, quite, you know, directly moves to the point of least pressure. Water, oil and gas are the obvious example. So, I mean, I got to tell you, this is not some brave new world we've entered into. I mean, we understand the law of correlative rights. We understand ownership in place, subject to regulation. So I don't think we need to, you know, step back and you know, bemoan the fact that landowners own groundwater, or that it's all in the same cycle. Of course it is. So I think these are complementary systems that can work very well together. So using those markets, how do we make sure we have water for wildlife? How do we make sure we have water for that part of the cycle that doesn't have any money? And how do we make sure we have more water for the future? I think it's interesting to look back and see where is water wasted and where is water conserved. I like to pick on Dallas. Anybody here from Dallas? Yeah, there you go. I don't know. I'm from South Texas. We just love to pick on people from Dallas. But look at the state. Look at all the different... nobody knows more about this than Weir. And all the great work he's done. But where water is conserved is where it's expensive. I feel like Yogi Berra again. My wife says, quit talking about Yogi Berra. Nobody knows who he is anymore. I'm looking out there and there are enough white heads. Yeah, you guys know Yogi Berra. Well, he's the greatest American philosopher. He had a firm, we still have, firm grasp of the obvious. And I think it's important to have a firm grasp of the obvious. Things are conserved when they're expensive, and they're wasted when they're cheap. And in certain places like Dallas, they had the political clout to get the rest of the state to subsidize the building of their reservoirs. So they got cheap water, and it's 110 degrees in August, and they flood the St. Augustine lawns and thumb their nose at people in San Antonio. Because they're not paying for their actions. San Antonio and El Paso conserve water because it's expensive. And how do you properly price water? And when I say price, I mean full cost accounting. I want the cost to the environment. I want the cost for the ducks. I want the cost for the quail and the deer and at the end of the line, the hooping cranes. So when you do all that, you know, it's pretty clear from the last 300 years that the best way to do that is with a private market. Is with private ownership gets you direct, real, what the economists call price signals. If you don't have those price signals, you have subsidies. Who gets subsidies? People with the most lobbyists, the most political influence, whoever can get their hand in the cookie jar. I don't think that's a good way to manage anything, but especially it's not a good way to manage a natural resource. So I have a little bit different perspective, I think, than some people about this perceived conflict between private property rights and groundwater and water management. I think private property rights are a good tool. I think they work. I think most, now, listen, I'm not naive. not all landowners are good, benevolent, you know, wildlife lovers, and, you know, take their time to do the best for the land. But very few of them are stupid enough to intentionally devalue their property. And you ask any ranch broker, land broker, farm broker, what's worth more, land with water on it or without water? So, you know, again, that pretty well explains itself. So where do we go from here? I think that we've got some really tough issues from the past that we've got to revisit. And, you know, it's like I used to tell the legislators when they would be mad at me, and I'd go up there and ask for park money with my friend George Bristol. What are you going to do to me? I'm unpaid and unelected. So, I guess I can say what I think. SB 1 was fatally flawed with the junior rights provision in surface water. One of the reasons we have been talking so much about groundwater, and we've had this incredible demand and pressure on groundwater for the last, help me George, 20 some odd years since SB 1, is because we took the water out, the surface water in East Texas, off the table. Before SB 1, there were over 190 interbasin transfers. Does everybody know what junior rights interbasin? Everybody kind of knows what that is. Before SB 1, you could move water without losing your priority, which is the value of your permit under a prior appropriation system. And it was a free market that worked. Sure, it was a regulated market, but 190 transfers tells you people were moving water to the benefit of both seller and buyer. There have been 3 interbasin transfer permits since Senate Bill 1. And what happened since then? Everybody made a rush on the groundwater. Now, East Texas will tell you, oh, we're just protecting our water. I thought it was state water. But for somewhere in East Texas, it's only East Texas state water. But you know, you've got to look at if we're going to look at the whole cycle, we can't divide. You know, you've got to look at the reality of aquifers. You've got to look at the reality of watersheds. And you can't ignore the obvious. So I think that's one thing. Number two, and I'll take some blame for this next one, because I worked on Senate Bill 2 and Senate Bill 3, is that I think we may have overdone the number of groundwater districts. When the Day case was being argued, I kind of laughed to myself. They were talking about the analogies to the oil and gas business. And I said, can you imagine regulating and having an oil and gas industry in Texas if we had 100 railroad commissions? Okay, you've got 100 and what, 2? 103? I mean, I haven't checked my email today, but you know, it's 100. It was 97, and I know we broke 100. Is that really an efficient way? Listen, I'm all for local control because I'm from a rural part of the state. I understand who has the votes. You know, I get that. But again, back to this, the water doesn't know. The water doesn't know where the county line is. And so having, as the judge said, having political boundaries for groundwater districts, they ignore the aquifer boundary because the water doesn't, you know, ignores that boundary. It's silly. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. If you're going to have a statewide water plan, as Ed Vaughn so famously put it, it's kind of hard to have a statewide plan if you have 100 different districts with different plans. So we talked about coming together, finding some collaboration. There's been great resistance by the groundwater districts to any encroachment on their powers. I understand that. I'm from a small rural community. Believe me, I get it. You know, what's the old story? Just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you. Because we know they're out to get us, right? We know the big cities want that water. But back to it. How do you protect that water? The best way to protect it is with a real price. Don't let them take it, make them pay for it, then you'll get real conservation. So I do think we need some general backdrops of rules, backstops for these districts, because some of these district rules are just so different from one another. It's kind of hard to get your mind around how there's going to be a statewide water plan with it the way it is today. It's really balkanization is what we have. And I think everybody needs to get in the room and realize that we do need a little bit more uniformity. We need to recognize regional needs. We need to recognize the science and the hydrology. But there have to be some basic guidelines that all of those groundwater districts follow. So with that, I am right on my 15 minutes. And I look forward to any questions.
Joseph, thank you very much. Our third panelist is Charlene Luhrig, who is an advocate for economic and environmental prosperity. She runs the Sustainable Water Infrastructure Program at CERES, a national nonprofit helping institutional investors to integrate sustainability into capital markets. Before coming to CERES, Ms. Luhrig was a fellow in the MIT USGS, U.S. Geological Survey, Science Collaborative at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, where she focused on the role of science in multi-stakeholder resource planning and dispute resolution. She holds a BA in Physics and English from Washington University in St. Louis and a Master's in City Planning from MIT. In her spare time, Ms. Luhrig writes about the springs of Texas on her blog, Hell's Oasis. She is an avid swimmer, kayaker, hiker, and lover of all things wild. Please welcome Charlene Luhrig.
Thank you all for inviting me here tonight. It's been wonderful to sit here and receive wisdom from others who've been in Texas for longer than I have and working on water issues for longer than I have. As we were mentioned, I spend my day job working with institutional investment funds and specifically working on water security and what that means for a country and a world where our water supplies are rapidly shrinking, even as our populations are growing. And I can say, specializing in infrastructure finance, that the decision that has been taken in Texas to put to the people a vote that would invest multiples of money, I mean, orders of magnitude more money into water infrastructure than any other state is considering, is energizing for people in other places in the United States who are encountering water security issues that are no less overwhelming than we in Texas face. But tonight I think it's really appropriate that even as we are pondering this investment in our water infrastructure, that we're talking about something that is vastly more important than infrastructure, and that is how we govern our water resources. Because if we do not match the investment we make in infrastructure with investments in science to understand the condition of our resource and the state of our resource, if we don't match our investment in infrastructure with an investment in governance structures that allow us to sustain that resource over time for the benefit of not only today's generations but future generations, then we will not sustain the resource. And so I congratulate Trenor University for having us ask these big questions. I moved back to Texas 2 years ago. I actually grew up not far from Dallas in Arlington. In a part of the state that did not have springs, at least not when I was growing up there. Arlington, I was surprised to learn, did in fact at one point have a mineral spring, but perhaps not surprisingly, they paved over it, which to me is a great parable for North Texas. So when I moved down here to Central Texas just a couple years ago, I was absolutely fascinated by springs. I'd never experienced them before, and I started traveling as much as I could to just understand them, to experience them, to know where they were and what they were about. And the more that I learned about springs, the more I realized how absolutely fundamental the health of our springs is to our water security as a state. Central Texas, West Texas, does not have rivers without springs. You have flash floods in which water moves quickly through the system and is lost. And then you have dry riverbeds. And in some ways, the drought that we've all been encountering for the past few years is a vision of our future if we fail to protect our spring flow, if we fail to protect groundwater at a level that allows those springs to flow in the future. And that means that there's no water for swimming, there's no water for wildlife. It is a deep cultural problem that we face. And it's made all the more complicated by what you've heard from the others here, which is that it's not something that individuals can solve alone. It's not a problem that ends at the property line. It's not a problem that ends at the county line. It's not even a problem that ends at the point when the spring comes out of the ground. And I would say that actually one of our biggest challenges with the management of the resources are that the groundwater conservation districts are constructed to represent the aquifers, but not to represent the surface water bodies that receive those waters. And are those any less important? And yet they are hugely disadvantaged when we look at the governance structure of groundwater conservation districts, which leaves to those local groundwater owners and other stakeholders the decision of whether or not to allow springs to flow. And in the state of Texas, there are very few springs that are actually protected by name. You know, you have Los Morris Springs in Brackettville. You have the springs that the Edwards Aquifer Authority oversees, San Marcos and Comal. Maybe there are a few others, but generally throughout the state, the way that groundwater conservation districts have elected to manage, to set management goals for themselves, is an average drawdown of the aquifer over time, without necessarily considering what the impact is on spring flow or surface water. And that, I think, is something that is arcane and mostly invisible to the average person who enjoys the springs and the rivers and the streams of Texas, whether that's recreationally or because it's their drinking water supply 200 miles away, or because it's a major industrial plant on the coast that receives those waters ultimately. And so the project that I've been working on in my spare time, Hell's Oasis, which actually came from a poem that my dad gave to me when I moved back down here, which was about the devil coming to Texas looking for a second home and eventually deciding that he was better off in hell, that it was too hot, there were too many things that stung, bit, whatever, and he just went back to hell. But that project that I've been working on has been an intention to make visible and make human, make real these choices that we are making every day in these arcane fields of groundwater conservation districts and the rest that very few people participate in directly. And to help people understand concretely that it's not just idle speculation that we might lose our springs, that if we can help people make a virtual visit to Fort Stockton in Comanche Springs, to a place that when my father was a child, he swam in, a desert wetland in Fort Stockton in the Permian Basin, that today if you visit, it's a municipal pool with a cage next to it, and the cage encloses a dry hole, and the dry hole is where Comanche Springs had once flowed. That if we can help people see that place, if we can help them see the blue hole in San Antonio, which is now a little wishing well that's on the campus of the Incarnate Word, a hole that you can look down to, the same, is utterly dry and has been dry since the big groundwater pumps got turned on in the Edwards Aquifer from Uvalde all the way to Medina and Bexar County. If we can help people understand that this is not speculation or theory, that these places have been lost and we stand to lose more unless we really carefully examine the choices that we make, then we will lose them. And once they are lost, it is hard to reclaim them. If you go to San Antonio and you walk along the Riverwalk, you're walking along the pathway of the waters that used to flow from that wishing well on the Incarnate Word campus. Those were the headwaters of the San Antonio River. The Riverwalk was too important for them to lose, right? The San Antonio River had to still exist. Now, what is the water that you're walking past on the Riverwalk? It's reclaimed sewage from the city's wastewater treatment plant that's pumped from the southern side of the city back uphill to Breckenridge Park and then allowed to flow back down to the city because that was an area that was so economically valuable they couldn't lose the water. Now, that works fine for a city like San Antonio, where you're dealing with 15 miles or so of an engineered river, but we can't imagine a future in which we can economically recreate the Guadalupe River, the Blanco River, the Nueces River. If we lose the natural hydrology of these systems, then we lose that river, those rivers, forever. And that has economic repercussions for the people in the Hill Country, right? It has cultural repercussions, but the economic repercussions are just as real. You know, the value of tourism and recreation here depends on those rivers flowing and those springs flowing. The value of people's property that is waterfront property depends on that water being there. The value of those working landscapes depend on the water being there. But it's not just an economic problem for the Hill Country. It's an economic problem that flows all the way down to the coastline, where you have those same spring-fed rivers that are feeding the state's most important chemical refineries. The Nueces River flows to Corpus Christi, which is now one of the largest natural gas ports in North America. When that base flow of those springs is eradicated, what will it mean for those communities and those economies as well? And I couldn't agree more that what this brings us to is a very important point in our history where we have to examine what do we get for free, what do we give away, and what compensation, not only what regulation is needed, but what compensation is needed between the keepers of those groundwater stores and the beneficiaries of the surface water supplies that are on the other end of that. I was struck by this multi-generational. To me, this is one of the defining issues that the generations represented in this room will tend together and will pass between each other. And I was struck by that when I visited the Devil's River, a place that's in far west Texas, not far from Del Rio. It's a beautiful river. It's one of our most pristine, maybe our most pristine still, turquoise water, beautiful fish, these ochre bluffs on either side. And one day when I was visiting, I swam across the river with a landowner, and we walked through a canyon and suddenly came upon this natural overhang, about 100 feet long, 20 or 30 feet high. And across this natural rock face is a mural. It's a mural that has been there for 4,000 years from these ancient tribes that lived along the river, the Devil's River. And it was almost as if it had been painted yesterday. It was so clear. You could see the deer escaping from hunters fleeing across this rock face. You could see warriors locked in battle with each other. And off to the far right side of it, you could see this character, the character who is now known as the White Shaman. This kind of faceless but very imposing presence with a huge bird on one shoulder. And as you stand there in this place and you look at him, you can see this figure regarding the scene that he is part of. But in a way, you could almost see him regarding us as well. And it was in that moment, looking at this place that has been important, where that water has been important for so long, that I realized we are within a generation that might see the passing of rivers that have kept us alive for 4,000 years, for that many generations, that we could actually see the passing of those places within such a short period of time. And that for us to have these conversations about what it means to govern this resource and what it means for us to choose to govern ourselves for future generations is the most important conversation we can be having. Are we bold enough to govern ourselves so that this gift that we have inherited from prior generations can pass on to the next? So thank you for having me here.
Charlene, thank you very much. I want to close the symposium tonight with a statement about Texas groundwater law made by Amy Hardberger in her blog on October the 2nd of this year. Amy is a very bright, young water lawyer. You probably know her father better. He was the mayor of the city of San Antonio. She wrote, and I quote, "People often cringe at the idea of regulation, particularly if it is perceived to be an infringement of private property rights. I understand those concerns, but I'd like to point out there's a cost of doing nothing. A cost, I would argue, that is far higher than trying to reduce groundwater pumping now in an effort to ensure water for all users in the future. Often we hear the choice being presented as regulation versus pump all you want. This is a false choice. For every property owner who wants to pump all they want, there's a neighboring property owner who wants to maintain their land and needs water available below their property to do so. We have an obligation to all of those people. No one has any bigger right than anyone else. So we must find a compromise where no one gets everything and everyone gets something." I think you've seen from these three panelists, I'm convinced that if you locked the three of them up in a room and told them to come up with a solution to our water needs into the future, being what I'm assuming them to be reasonable people with different perspectives, that they could do so. And that's what we have to do. We have to get people together and talk about it and discuss it and understand that we have to create this balanced answer between the stakeholders. Not necessarily change laws or anything. Probably some laws need to get changed. But on the whole, we can come up with a balanced solution. I'm convinced of it. But we have a huge challenge ahead of us. I thank each of you for being here tonight, and I hope that you will attend the next Texas Water Symposium. Thank you very, very much.
We have time to take some questions from our speakers. So if you are interested in asking the questions, raise your hand and I'll bring the mic to you.
Thank you. With all due respect to our speakers, I've been hearing for many years that Weir Labatt knows more about water than anybody else in Texas. So I'd like to address my question to you. I have heard again for years that we could solve the water problems in Texas for many years if we could make use of the brackish and saline water, trillions of gallons of water that isn't potable now, but presumably could be turned into potable water. I'd like to hear your assessment of that and specifically what you see as being done in that area.
I think
is the mic off?
Yeah, that's good.
You bring up a very good point. Brackish water, there's 2.7 billion acre feet of brackish water in the state of Texas. That's what the Texas Water Development Board studies show. And it's located primarily in areas where there's a scarcity of water, to the west. And I think we're going to be using brackish water more and more. Now, it's more expensive than some of the other sources, but it's a huge potential. The San Antonio Water System is building a large brackish facility right now. But it's run into a problem with groundwater conservation districts, where no scientific or hydrological reasons, only political reasons, the Evergreen Water District has not allowed SAWS to pump any water from Wilson or Atascosa, brackish water from Wilson or Atascosa County. That's one of the fixes that the legislatures looked at the last session and is going to have to work on, because brackish water is not being used by anybody else, not going to be used by agriculture for sure, because it's too expensive once they clean it up. Huge potential, and I think you'll be seeing a lot more about that. You'll be seeing modular desal plants, smaller modular desal plants throughout the state of Texas, particularly out west. Huge source, huge potential.
What about saline water? I grew up in the areas of where the Salt Fork of the Red and the Salt Fork of the Brazos and so forth, there was an awful lot of salty water coming downstream from up from those
places. All those waters can get cleaned up. It's the same as brackish water. It's just you have to run it through probably a reverse osmosis system, and that's expensive. And water, I think we all agree to this, water's too cheap. Joseph, you said that. We all are used to cheap water. And the only way you're going to get water to be appreciated more is to do it on an inverted block rate basis. I'm talking particularly for cities. The more you use, the more you pay. And if we need an alternate source, we need water. If Kerrville needs water and there's brackish water available, then you're going to wind up paying more for it.
Thank you.
Other questions?
I'm particularly interested in the amendment that's coming up, and I think it was mentioned that the politicalization of water resources is and will be a problem. The amendment that's coming up for a vote about transferring several hundred thousand or billions, I'm not sure, from the rainy day fund to be bid on, I'm using my own words, by private sectors to develop brackish water or whatever water sources. My concern is that this is placing this directly in the middle of a political hayride.
Let me take that one. I served on the Texas Water Development Board for 10 and a half years. We've loaned out in 56 years $14 billion worth of loans. They're almost 99.9% all to political subdivisions, river authorities, water systems. There's really nothing that's gone to the private sector. So the idea in the $2 billion you're talking about is to help support the programs that are the Texas Water Development Board is like a big bank, and they loan out the money. I said we loaned out $14 billion. And over the 56 years, we've had zero default on those loans. Not a single dollar has been lost by the state of Texas. But they're all the political subdivisions. And this notion is going out against Prop 6, which is $2 billion to support different conservation efforts, disadvantaged communities, even the large cities. Is completely untrue because the money's not going to be bid on. You have to have a sponsoring political subdivision to go to the Water Development Board and seek a loan from the board. And they're all projects that are felt needed by whatever political subdivision it is.
Exactly. And that's what my point is. We have all these political subdivisions going in all different directions.
How would you?
Their own little deal, and what we were just—I just heard y'all say that we ought to be doing this as a group and one with one goal.
Unless you had the state implement all the plans, the state doesn't support any of the projects. They all come from either the regional or the local levels. The state. That doesn't. So I don't know. If you wanted it to all come from the state, then you'd have to make there'd be some major changes.
One thing that I think is important that gets to the point that you're inquiring about is that if this money were to be put into the fund for water infrastructure for the first time ever, both the regional planning groups and the board itself would have to prioritize the projects and the spending, and that's a really important difference. Right now, the way the board has traditionally managed those loans. Has been kind of first come, first serve in the application process. And that's a really important point to consider. It's not a perfect process, but it is beginning to try to whittle down from that multitude of projects and really focus on priorities.
Let me say this, because Weir's very modest fella. The Texas Water Development Board, in my opinion, has done a very good job. In the last session, they came under fire from certain political corners that, in my opinion, was undeserved. I don't know if any private banks have lent $14 billion and not a single bad loan. It's very good record. But I share some of your concern about the first of all, I'm not sure $2 billion is even close to enough money. That if anybody thinks $2 billion is going to solve the problem, it isn't. It's a good start. But I would like to see in that prioritization program, in that system, that we really look at the efficiencies. For instance, a number of cities have done great work in reducing the amount of waste in their systems. A lot of older cities have water systems that just, you wouldn't believe it, like 15, 20%, 50 in some places, right? I mean, that's crazy. Well, I remember doing some work with Thames Water, a private water company, one time, and they said, what's the first thing you do? You take over a city's water system. And they fix the leaks. It's the cheapest water there is. I mean, the water you've already paid for and spill, I mean, it's pretty another Yogi Berra moment. Duh. I mean, that's the cheapest water in the world. And I want to make sure we're looking at those sort of projects before we build reservoirs. And I'm not going to... Well, you know, all of us in the wildlife community have a thing about unnecessary reservoirs. I mean, some of them have been built that have been in an advantage to wildlife. Some of them have been boondoggles. And, again, you don't want a system where, like in the Farm Bill, where you have everybody pays, but only a few people benefit. I don't know if you've read Cadillac Desert or any of the history of Western water management, but, you know, it's a classic story of none of those big dam projects would have been built if the farmers who benefit from them had to pay for it. They would have found other more efficient ways to irrigate. And so I hope we don't go down that old model. I hope we start using some more innovative models and start thinking seriously about what Charlene was saying. And, you know, when I talk about water's too cheap, I mean, it really needs to be expensive. It needs to be so expensive that those groundwater districts have to preserve those spring flows, because that spring flow is on my property, and now it's a constitutional taking of my property and my values when you allow people to dry up my spring. Now that water is really expensive. When the water gets really expensive, you'll be amazed what happens. I've spent the last 30 years in the oil and gas field. There's a lot more $100 oil than there is $30 oil. Why is that? You attract capital. You attract capital and technology. You see what they do in Israel with the water they have. And you look at our irrigation practices. Well, the only way, you know, what was the plan I saw that they're predicting 30 to 40% of the water in the state water plan is going to come from ag savings. Well, where's that going to come from? You got to have the capital to invest in the new technology to still have a farming community that's farming with 20 or 30 or 40% less water. That takes money, which means they have to be able to sell the saved water. And they're going to have to sell it at a price that attracts the capital. I mean, this is, you work with investment bankers all the time. This is Econ 101. And I'm not sure that the politicians are ready to tell the people how expensive water is going to be if we're going to save the Devil's River and all those springs and the ducks and everything else. So,
I would like to just address Prop 6. briefly, from my own experience, the revolving loan fund that the Water Development Board has run for these 56 years has been one of the things that's kept rural Texas alive. So these political subdivisions we're talking about, in a lot of cases, they're small counties like my county, Real County, or it's a small city like the city of Lakey. And if they need to go in and fix the water leaks in their public water supply, they get an estimate from the engineer that says that you need $175,000 or $250,000. Well, they don't have that kind of money on hand, and there's no way they're going to get that money. They can't do those projects to fix the leaks or to extend the service as they need to. The only way they can get that money is to go to the Water Development Board, get a low-interest or no-interest loan, and then over 20 years pay it back with slightly increased water rates. And so for without that, you would not see these kind of rural communities that are places where people can live because they have water. It just wouldn't be there.
A question for the judge, please. Judge, if you can, and if you're willing, would you care to tie all this together and as it relates to an incident that occurred in Kimball County on West Bear Creek last month with regard to a TCEQ possible illegal taking? And are you aware of that incident, and are you willing to contact comment on it?
I am aware of it, and so just a little background. My understanding of it is that there was a landowner that had a dam on his or her property and had been there for a long time, possibly generations. And due to some information received by TCEQ, they went out and looked at this dam and determined that the stream bed on which the dam was fell within the way that we define in the state of Texas navigable water that under some statutes belongs to the state of Texas. And so the TCEQ said, we have regulatory authority over this dam, and you have to, we're going to issue him a citation, and he ended up taking the dam out, as I understand. This is a tremendous issue for the Texas Hill Country, and it affects every one of us. I personally do not care for the way that navigable water is defined with regard to what property is owned by the state of Texas. I think we're so far away from the reality of what that those statutes were meant to do, which is to protect water, surface water for the state, that we're just a problem in search of a definition at this point. So I would love to see some action taken to go back and to look at those definitions and to make them match the reality of where we are. I'm okay with reasonable, thought-out, discussed regulation to protect water quality, but we're beyond the pale as far as private property rights. I don't want people walking up the gravel bar through the middle of a piece of property that I have because it's 30 feet wide. And that's unfortunately kind of the situation we find ourselves in now.
Define navigable water for
everybody. So navigable water in Texas is a stream bed that is 30 feet wide on average from source to terminus. And you, right, so cut bank to come bank. Vegetation line is what Parks and Wildlife uses. So I think we've hopefully all had an experience where we're standing in a stream and you look up and there's a bank on one side and there's some vegetation and there's a bank on the other with vegetation. And so you measure that, but you don't just measure it where you're standing. I mean, you have to measure it the full distance of that stream bed, and you would be amazed at the number of stream beds, gravel bars, draws, sloughs, whatever your definition, wherever you're from, that are going to fall within that definition.
And they can be dry.
They can be dry, and that's another thing. So I sit in my county judge office in Lakey, and I have this conversation with these people, and it always starts this. This is a gravel bar. There's no water there. Yes, I know. I'm sorry about that. But it's only 10 feet wide here. Yes, I know. I'm sorry about that. And it goes on and on, because those are the rules we're dealing with. And I think that hopefully this Kimball County case is going to let us take a really good look at that and come up with something that's practical. We need something that's practical, and this rule is not practical, in my opinion.
Hello. I'm an old engineer, been in business a long, long time. And what's going to happen to us down the road? We're going to have to start thinking about desalination of waters that come in our Gulf. And there's no way in the world that we can keep supporting people when we get to 50 million people if we don't do something like that. And if you look at Israel or Saudi, you'll see desalination plants that are 20 or 30 miles long. I don't mean just little cheeky bird plants. I mean those plants are 20 or 30 miles long. And they have literally turned those deserts into oases with that water. But the last numbers I saw in cost of water, it's about $1 per gallon. So I'm sure with our technology, as it gets better and better, which it does, the price will come down, but people need to start thinking about water. Water's going to be more expensive than gasoline by the time a lot of you young people pass away, I'll tell you. And so we need to start doing something now to figure out how to take advantage of the water that's in the seas. Thank you.
We have time for maybe one more question.
First, I want to thank y'all for the presentation. Everyone that contributed, I believe, added value to what we're discussing. That's water needs of our state for the future. But I guess my question is really directed towards Joseph. My family background is from farming ranch as well. And, you know, there's a saying in farming ranch as well as ag that it all gets down to carrying capacity. And it's the same in water. I guess my eyes have been opened recently, and I've not been in real estate as long as David, but in taking a Master Naturalist course here recently. And I would ask, are we doing any outreach to the kids? Because once you, in my view, my wife teaches third and fourth grade, Ambleside and Fredericksburg, once you educate the kids, then they begin to realize that this is way beyond government. So I guess my appeal would be to you to go beyond government and get to the kids, because it's my understanding that by 2060, if things don't change in Texas, we will be out of groundwater. And would ask that you comment on that for us, please.
Well, I think you're exactly right, and there are a couple of organizations that are doing a very good job, I think, in educating not only school children, but a lot of times the parents need just as much or more education on basic hydrology, you know, what you just saw there. Texas Wildlife Association, David Langford's just been a great, great crusader of the whole, you know, of how the water cycle works and educating people on land management practices, and that, you know, it determines the yield of water, how you manage land. Parks and Wildlife, I think, has done a great job. But I think it needs to become part of the curriculum. You know, when I went to school, there were certain things, you know, there were certain years that were civics, and seventh grade was Texas history, and you know, somewhere in there, they need to get natural history. And to really understand the basics of land management and hydrology and the natural world, the connection, you know, between the Double Mountain Fork of the Brazos and Hooping Cranes. And, you know, most people kind of like, what connection could there possibly be? I think you're right. It's something we need to do, because at the end of the day, the politicians are going to listen to the voters. And if the voters don't care about the Devil's River, then the Devil's River's not going to survive.
All right, thank you very much. Let's thank Weir and our panel. And I'd like to thank you all for visiting Shriner tonight. Have a safe trip home.
Thank you.